Justice Owen had to leave for Washington. I think you can see her on C-SPAN tomorrow morning if you get up early with the president. But she will, in all likelihood, be here to consider in the deliberation and decisions of this case, In re Kansas City Southern Industries, and we're ready to hear argument from Relator.
May it please the court, Mr. Mitchell Smith will present argument for the Relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. In Texas, a guardian ad litem cannot execute an affidavit and sign a settlement agreement for a minor when that minor has not been interviewed by the ad litem, when that minor's whereabouts are unknown at the time of the settlement and the time the affidavit was executed, and if that minor's very existence is an unknown. In permitting the guardian ad litem to take those acts, the trial court failed to analyze and apply the law correctly. She approved of a legal fiction, and that legal fiction permitted the guardian ad litem to exceed the authority that he or she have in the state of Texas.
Was there ever an attorney ad litem appointed to try to find the unlocated and, I think, as you call, the missing minors?
Not that I know of, Your Honor. As far as I know, Mr. Smith, J.P. Smith, was the guardian ad litem that was appointed, and he is the only ad litem, guardian or attorney otherwise, that have or has been appointed in this case. Very briefly, I'd like to clarify that we are not here today complaining in any way of the conduct of plaintiff's counsel, Mr. Schneider and Mr. Grady. They took over a case that was completely unmanageable. They got it organized. They spent countless hours getting this thing ready for mediation. They were professional. They were aggressive. They were fair. They were very good attorneys to work with. The same with Mr. Smith, the guardian ad litem. We're not alleging any type of bad faith conduct or anything unethical on their part. They were very clear with the court when this issue came up. They argued, and effectively to the trial court, that the guardian ad litem has this authority in the state of Texas. We argued differently, and the trial court agreed with them. So I just wanted to clarify, if it wasn't clear from our briefs, that we are not complaining of their acts, either plaintiff's counsel that are here before you today, or Mr. Smith ad litem.
One of these missing minors shows up and wants their $74, or wants more than the $74 that they were allotted. Are they bound by this judgment, in your opinion, or is it void as to them?
We have taken the position, and in looking at the law, Your Honor, that if they show up, the judgment is binding on them. They can go down to the registry of the court and get the $74 is their portion from the KCSI, but they can get their total lump sum settlement. The second part of your question, if they don't like that settlement, where do they go? Well, if you look at the Grunewald opinion, I would believe that they might have a private cause of action against the ad litem for breach of fiduciary duty.
But if the trial judge had no authority to appoint the ad litem for them, and the ad litem exceeded his authority in approving the settlement, how come this missing, unrepresented, unknown client is bound?
Well, the judge? If they do exist, I mean, there's a question of whether or not these people actually exist. There was a companion.
Let's assume they exist, because it's too existential.
Okay.
Whether you're bound by something if you don't exist.
If they are there, I think in applying or in looking at the law and applying the law, that if they show up, the affidavit is valid. It would be similar to a parent challenging the validity of the affidavit or the validity of the settlement. And again, that falls back to they would have no standing to complain about it.
Then how are you irreparably harmed?
We're irreparably harmed.
You've bought your piece. Whether they spend it or not, I don't see as any concern of yours. If you've agreed to a judgment and now they're bound by it, then declare victory and go home.
Well, I think that's the position the other three defendants took, Your Honor. My client, and I respectfully argue, thinks that although they may have bought their piece to those that have come forward and taken their money, and the vast majority of those have, they gave their money. They paid $300,000 with the understanding that there were 1,100 plaintiffs. That turned out not to be the case. We're still missing almost 300 people, that adds up to $64,000. And although they may have bought their piece for those that we can find, they have not. They have been irreparably harmed in that they gave this money for something that is no longer there.
But how come that can't be appealed one day? After all, either get a severance and appeal it now, or try all these adults and get that out of the way, and then complain that you'd like your money back.
I think you have to look at the specific circumstances of this case, Your Honor. This case involved thousands of plaintiffs in the Cashmere neighborhood in Houston, Texas. There was a companion case that broke off from the Douglas matter that was refiled. It was non-suited here in Harris County. It was refiled in Jefferson County on the eve of limitations. That case was called to trial. The party settled before trial. This case continued. At one time, it had 20 different plaintiff's attorneys. When the present counsel got the thing organized, got it managed, my client had not been sued by the minors. We had only been sued by one intervener, Arthur Faye Sledge, and Ms. Sledge's suit was the only suit pending against the KCSI at the time of the settlement. What we had was the threat of all these minors coming forward who did not have limitations issues and filing suit, and that's what we settled. When that settlement was approved, Judge Jameson still had before her viable and live claims against the Union Pacific and Nalco Chemical Company. Those cases, those claims were still pending. There were some logistical issues in those claims in that Mr. Schneider and Mr. Grady did not represent all of the plaintiffs from that still had claims against UP and Nalco. So there was a very good question back last fall when this all came forward is whether or not, when would a final judgment ever be entered? And the interlocutory judgment that we had before us adjudicated the rights of KCSI, but was not a final judgment. And in looking at this court, what this court said in Mid-America, the petition for writ of mandamus was appropriate because we did not have an adequate remedy at law. If we waited, and we had no idea at that time how long it would be before there was a final judgment, I mean, we've lost the use of our money for that much longer period of time. That's why.
What's an interlocutory final judgment?
Well, it was final to some parties. It adjudicated the rights of some parties. It adjudicated the rights of the minors, but it was still interlocutory because, as I understood the situation, and none of these claims were pending against my client, he still had a bulk of adult claimants who had filed lawsuits and served Nalco Chemical Company and the Union Pacific Railroad. And those claims were still pending. Some of those claims, I believe, were being handled by Mr. Grady and Mr. Schneider. And the rest of those claims were being handled by two attorneys who we knew in name only. They had attended part of the mediation and left without ever making an announcement of appearance. They had come to two different hearings before Judge Jameson without announcing and without making an appearance and left during those hearings. So we knew we had this mystery group of plaintiffs somewhere. And what you see in the situation we have with the minor plaintiffs, tracking all of these people was an impossibility, especially with the split off between the two suits.
How can a guardian or anybody settle a claim for somebody they can't even find?
Your Honor, that's the issue we have. We say that he or she cannot settle that claim if he or she cannot find that minor.
Well, then it shouldn't be res judicata. I mean, they should be out, but they shouldn't be bound by the settlement or a judgment if they can't. They don't even know what's happening.
What we found out, what has seemed to have occurred and what we thought would occur is as these people show up, they go and they get an order from Judge Jameson permitting them to withdraw their funds from the registry of the court. They go down to the district clerk, they withdraw their funds.
Has that been happening?
That has happened, and that happened at the time that the real parties filed their brief on the merits. They filed affidavits of 103, approximately that number, additional minors that have appeared since we perfected the petition for writ of mandamus. That drops the number down from 381 to approximately 285, being the number that we're dealing with today, as I understand it. But my client has taken somewhat of a dangerous position in this case, because if this court grants us the relief and returns this money, I don't think they're going to be issue or claim precluded from turning around later on down the road if they want to and file suit against KCSI or KCSR. And that's not a position I'm advocating, but that is the result of the legal issue before the court today. And at that time, we would assert our defenses that we had in the underlying case in the first place. We did not believe that we were a tortfeasor. The car that was involved in this thing was accidentally given to us by another railroad. We immediately gave it back. That was kind of our defense.
In your reply brief, you indicate that three or four of the minors were born a year after the accident occurred. Are those three or four part of the 285, or were they part of the 381?
We took the position when we looked at those affidavits that they were never a part of the original 381 minors. They have birth dates that occurred well over a year after the accident in question. We don't know where they came from. They're not on any plaintiff chart that we maintained either in the Douglas action or in the West action. For purposes of this argument, we conceded that we just go ahead and knock them off the 381 and agree with the real parties in interest that the number of missing minors is 285. At some point in time, if our argument is accepted, a determination is going to have to be made, whether it is a determination of looking at the record or just setting forth an order with a date that says after this date, if minors have not appeared to move their registry of the court or appeared for the registry of the court to get their money back, the KCSI portion of that, and KCSI is the only defendant asking this, would get their portion for that number back. I don't know. I can't figure out how to do it otherwise, because the number has been and remains fuzzy. Several of these plaintiffs were plaintiffs in the West case. We know of several of the plaintiffs, even looking back in the adult plaintiffs, who have been to the well two and three times. They've come in under different names, or their situation has changed with their address, or they have a different Social Security number. And the number of people that brought suit is just so great that it was almost an impossible task in getting this thing organized and settled. And again, that's where I commend opposing counsel in doing a fine job of getting that all together and getting it organized.
Could you explain to me once again what effort you made to get this judgment final as to all the people who have had their money and had relief? Or alternatively, final as to these judgments, so that this could go up through the regular appellate channels and not through an attempt at mandamus?
We did it, Your Honor. In looking at the law, we determined that the most prudent and, most judicious, in our opinion, manner in which to handle this was through a petition for writ of mandamus. We'd already paid our money. Our money had been paid over 6 months previously. We had lost the use of that money.
Let's ask the question in a slightly different way. What steps could you take to make this judgment final so it could be subject to appeal?
I think we could have attempted to get the thing severed out and then have a final appealable judgment at that time. Again,
get what severed?
Once the minors were settled, and Ms. Sledge, and we paid to settle her claim, the KCSI was done, along with Illinois Central Railroad. Those were the only live claims against us. So the interlocutory judgment that Judge Jameson signed on October 15th effectively adjudicated the rights of both the KCSI and the Illinois Central Railroad. And we thought or looked at the possibility of asking Judge Jameson to sever out that portion of the judgment and make that a final judgment, because it would dispose of all the claims and all the parties involved relating to the miners. In reading the case law and what is and what is not an adequate remedy at law, we made the determination that it was the more prudent action to just go ahead and file a petition for writ of mandamus complaining of what we claimed was the excessive acts of the guardian ad litem in this case, and the legal fiction in misapplying the legal fiction that was permitted by the trial court in misanalyzing and misapplying the law in this case.
But that would be abuse of discretion, but you also have to show an inadequate remedy by appeal, and we've repeatedly said expense and delay is not enough.
But it is part of it. And if you look at the Mid-American case, the court in 1995, says if a normal appeal is too burdensome and the delay is too long, then, and I believe this is in the Walker case at all.
And the burdensomeness here would be, did you say $64,000 that you're deprived of for a period of time?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you could have arguably gotten a severance pretty immediately and taken it right up. So the delay would be insignificant, really.
I'm not sure how easy this. I don't know if everything in this case was so difficult. I'm not sure that a severance would have been as easy in this case as a severance normally would be. I have severed a case before.
But it would be your burden to show that somehow that you couldn't get it severed easily.
Correct. I think what we were looking at in this case, in analyzing whether or not we had an adequate remedy at law, is which was the most efficient and most prudent way to do it, accompanied with an abuse of discretion, which we argue the trial court committed an abuse of discretion on this legal question. We're not arguing about the underlying factual issues, whether or not the ad litem breached a fiduciary duty or followed the dictates of the Texas Family Code. We have an overall legal question that we think there was an abuse of discretion there. Then you analyze whether or not we had an adequate remedy of law. And Mid-American, clearly says that an order affecting, an order that has the effect of adjudicating the rights of a party, and that order is not immediately appealable, then you don't have an adequate remedy by appeal, and you may exercise the extraordinary writ of petition for writ of mandamus. I don't know, in trying to answer your question honestly, how easily it would have been to get a severance of this case. We thought we had a pretty clear, pretty narrow legal issue that could very quickly be brought up through the courts of appeal by mandamus action, and that it was appropriate for mandamus consideration without getting the severance and taking it up through the normal avenue of appeal.
So, Mr. Yeah. Smith, just one last is $64,000 is what we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. The number we know is $300,000.
All right. But in other words, you'd rather have the $64,000 back rather than taking the chance, after all the organization and planning they've done to settle this case, you'd rather take your $64,000 back and than to stand the chance of maybe getting this case resolved and getting this case basically taken care of itself, letting Judge Jameson get the case off the docket.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's the risk that KCSI is willing to take. They thought they bargained for X. They found out later that was not the case. It added up to a substantial amount of money. I believe it's real parties in interest have referred to it as a meager settlement. Individually, it may be somewhat meager. I think $75 isn't meager, but when you multiply it, it comes out to $64,000. And KCSI would rather have the money back and run the risk of defending these suits later on, if in fact they're ever brought, than to buy the piece right now.
Thank you, counsel. Court has raised your argument from real parties.
Peter Schneider will present argument for the real party in interest. Mr. Grady will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, members of the court, a wise jurist once said in an award-winning speech that she gave entitled Protecting the Best Interest of Our Children, that the state shall act as parens patriae, or the parent of the country for its children. The reason that the state does that, acts on behalf of the children, is that the adults in this state and this country have a right to liberty. The children have a right to custody. Out of the almost 6 million children that reside in this state, 1.5 of those children live in poverty. The children at issue in this case are part of that 1.5 million children. They're poor. Most of them at the time that the case was brought resided in the 5th Ward here in Houston, Harris County, Texas. They lack permanent addresses, some of them. Some of them are somewhat migratory with their parents. And as the ad litem said, and more than one occasion in his comments to the trial court, that these children are part of a highly mobile population. So obtaining them and getting them at any particular time may be difficult. This case really involves three issues involving a guardian ad litem appointed under Rule 173 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. It deals with the purpose of a guardian ad litem, the power of a guardian ad litem, and the duties of the guardian ad litem. Because although Relator wants to say that their complaint here is with the trial court, with Judge Jameson, their complaint is really with the guardian ad litem, J.P. Smith. Let's look first at the purpose of a guardian ad litem, which this case is not found in our brief because it was decided by this very court on July 3rd, the day before our glorious holiday of this year, approximately 4 months ago in the case of Roberts versus Williamson. Chief Justice Phillips, writing on behalf of a 9-0 court on this issue, stated that a guardian ad litem does not serve for the benefit of all parties. A guardian ad litem is appointed to protect the child's interest, the child and the child only. Therefore,
how can you protect the child if you can't find the child? Doesn't know who the child is, sure.
That is a valid and a good question, Justice Hecht, and my answer would be the same way that the legislature on at least three different occasions has indicated that a guardian ad litem would protect those people whose whereabouts were unknown. In the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 64-102, Subsection B, the legislature, when appointing a guardian ad litem for someone who may have a mineral interest, stated that the court may appoint a guardian ad litem for a missing person if the court determines the appointment is in the best interest of the
missing person. Is that an attorney ad litem who does a totally different hat?
An attorney ad litem does wear a completely different hat than a guardian ad litem.
And an attorney ad litem is to find someone who's missing as opposed to protecting the interests of someone who's there. Isn't that the distinction?
Yes, Justice O'Neill, I believe that is correct. The second law from the legislature probably makes a little more sense than the receiver for a mineral interest, and that is the creation of a trust. Under the Texas Property Code, the Texas Trust Code, it says the court may appoint, this is specific language from the legislature, may appoint a guardian ad litem to represent the interest of a minor, an incapacitated person, unborn or unascertained person, or person whose identity or address is unknown. So a guardian ad litem can be appointed to represent someone whose whereabouts are unknown if it's for purposes of a trust, as well determining heirship under the probate code. Probate code section 53 says that if it appears to the court that there are or may be living heirs whose names or whereabouts are unknown, the court may, in its discretion, appoint a guardian ad litem to represent that person's interest.
So your position is that this judgment is final as to these 285 or however many children there are that have not shown up?
Absolutely.
So if they come in and they've got serious injuries, they're just, it's just too bad. I mean, they could sue the guardian ad litem, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor, and that
probably not get very much there. So their claims are just gone.
Well, yes, their claims are gone, would be gone under that scenario, Your Honor. But
how can that be justified? It's hard to see how that can be justified, that you could settle somebody's claims for a small amount of money, $100 or so, and you don't even know whether they're seriously injured, not seriously injured, or even where they are.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, that if that was the case in this case, but it's not, because the evidence in this case indicates, and looking at that first element under the Byrd case out of Dallas, which is the ad litem should look at the damages suffered by the minors, this case could be best termed as a good liability, bad damage case. That's what we call it, an acute exposure, minor injury case. And all the evidence in this case indicates 731 parental affidavits that were presented to the trial court, as well as 381 affidavits from the guardian ad litem, who he had seen over 2,000 children, all indicate that with regard to this particular case, every minor with a claim as a result of this spill recovered from the temporary effects of the acrylamide that they inhaled. There was no permanent injury, and that there were no ongoing symptoms.
Now, how did the guardian ad litem conclude that as to the 381 unlocated minors? Was that from reviewing records?
Reviewing the individual information that we had on each one of those people.
Now, the guardian ad litem, I remember reading in the briefing, it's alleged that he indicated that at some point in time he probably saw most or maybe all of these minors. But did he say for the 381 in those individual affidavits that he prepared that he had seen all of those minors, interviewed all of those? But no, he couldn't say that for sure.
No, he could not say that for sure. And to answer your question, there's nowhere in those 381 affidavits that he says that he saw each one of these children. But he did say, as you pointed out, Your Honor, that he had probably at one time or another seen each one of these minors, and that's because he was the ad litem not only in the Douglas case, but in the West case. So he had control and saw over 2,000 children in this case. So if he only saw 1,700...
How current were the records he looked at?
I'm sorry?
How current were the records he looked at? The point, again, is these records stopped at a certain point in time. There was some latent injury, latent condition these children suffered. They showed up later with some very serious injuries. Under your approach, they'd be bound to $74.
They would, Your Honor, but in this case, there are no evidence of any latent injuries that acrylamide, the chemical at issue here, has ever caused any person, adult or child. The ad litem made the decision for these 381 minors 4 years after this accident happened. And during that four-year period, after dealing with 2,000 different minors, came to the conclusion that not only had a particular group of them not suffered any ongoing symptoms or long-term effects, that there was no evidence that even one of them did. So that also applies to the adults in this case, which is the very reason that this case, when it was resolved, is why it was in the best interest of the children to settle this case. One of the reasons it was in the best interest to settle, and the reason that this settlement was adequate for them, was because of the low offers made by each defendant, the low offer being the defendant's last offer. The ad litem described that at the trial court as being that decision to accept that small offer is basically being a no-brainer, that he could get something for them or nothing for them. So that decision for him was very easy. In fact, his exact words were, "It's simply not logical to argue that the relatively small amounts of money being paid to these minors are not in their best interest." You also
seems to me that cuts both ways.
Yeah.
If it's not very much money, why not just split them out and hope, you know, if they show up someday and they want to sue them, they can, and if they don't, they don't. Why? if it's not very much money, then it doesn't. Then I don't understand why it's important to settle the claims of people you can't find.
Because they made the offer, Justice Heck. They made the offer to each one of these minors, and someone with authority, that being the guardian ad litem, looked at this and asked himself the question: is this offer ever going to come back? And
well,
based upon the circumstances in the case,
is it true that at the time the offer was made, everybody thought all of the children would show up?
I don't know the answer to that question. I would think that if that were the assumption, that they would have put that in the agreement that they drafted and sent to us. None of the other three defendants ever asked for any money back, and none of the three defendants put that particular provision, what you're referencing, in their agreement, and neither did Relator. And
do you anticipate that the money from the other settlements is just going to sit in the registry of the court until somebody shows up that they don't?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the money, once the children turn 18 years of age, that what's going to happen is what has been happening, is they're going to go down and pick up their money. We ran into a lot of problems with some of these minors' parents who wanted the money for themselves, and said, if we're only getting $700 or $800 or $500, then I want that money now to go buy gym equipment for my kid. For whatever reason, they wanted the money. And to protect the child against that, the money was put into the registry of the court. So we were also dealing with people who, when you would send them a letter and say that there's been an offer made to your child, and you know we need to meet with you and stuff, some of the people wouldn't respond because they were fearful that that was the local government's way of collecting on traffic tickets. So we ran into numerous problems in getting the people to participate, some of these parents to participate.
Let me understand, did you say this, in your opinion, this judgment is final?
Yes, Your Honor. It's final as to the minors, yes.
It hadn't been severed.
It has not been severed.
And it's in, looked like to me, the order said something that says they rendered as to the adults, but didn't render as to these 381 people.
I may have misunderstood what you said. When we entered into, when we presented the interlocutory final judgment to the court, that was only as it applied to the minor cases. All of the adult cases that were settled were non-suited. And the reason that it was interlocutory was because there were approximately 120 adult claims of people that we couldn't locate as well. And through the course of diligence during the course of this appeal, that number dwindled to 47. So we have found additional adults, and we didn't reach out and start that search for what they termed these missing minors because we thought someone with authority had already accepted the money.
Well, just factually, though, about what the judge signed, there's nothing in the record indicating this is a final judgment other than the words final, interlocutory final judgment. You didn't, basically, it's not, the judge didn't render on that agreement?
There is a provision in the interlocutory final judgment that says that the court intends to enter final judgment once the remaining adult cases have been resolved, either by way of dismissal with prejudice if they don't come forward for trial. That would be the way that they would be disposed of. And at that time, I think that's when the court would enter final judgment. As Justice Schneider well knows, you can't have two final judgments.
Mr. Grady, if we were to hold that the judgment was final as to the missing minors in this case, and you say there's no harm done because these are really not, these are insignificant claims generally, I mean the monetary amount is not that significant, what would be the effect of a holding that says a judgment is final in a case where those claims could be significant, where serious injuries are later brought by the minors, and they're attempting to recover millions of dollars of damages for the conduct of the defendant? If we were to hold that they're out in this case, the judgment is preclusive in this case, why wouldn't it be in that case? And if it is, why would that be a good principle for us to establish?
I think in the scenario that you pose, that it could be a problem if the kids later come back and say this settlement was inappropriate.
But it would be a strange rule to alter the res judicata effect of a final judgment depending on factual circumstances that might later arise.
That, And I think that that's why it's best left to the trial courts when appointing a guardian ad litem and viewing the circumstances as to what is in the best interest of the child. If the trial judge the trial judge is in the best position to determine if there's been enough done to satisfy that best interest determination to give that judgment preclusive effect in the future.
Just subject to abuse of discretion review?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that has worked in this state. It's appropriate in this state to give the trial judges the discretion to determine if enough has been done to meet the best interest of the child standard.
Any other questions? We have another counsel that wants to argue.
I can ask the next counsel.
All right.
May it please the court.
You've got a few seconds, counsel. I've got a question for you.
Yes, sir. I wanted to address Justice Heck's question because it's a question that I asked myself over and over while preparing for this case. How can a guardian ad litem settle a claim for someone that he can't find? I think, Justice Heck, that there has been a misstatement or a misreading of the status of these 285 minors. These 285 minors aren't in a category of being missing or their whereabouts unknown. In this population of 285 minors, there are many children, as Mr. Grady pointed out, whose parents simply refused to sign the affidavit because they wanted to get the money for themselves. They would come to the town meetings that we hosted and said, I need that money for food, or I need it for a soccer uniform. And the ad litem got up and said, I'm approving all these settlements. I appreciate and I will listen to your objection, but the offers are in the best interest of the children. There were parents who simply refused to participate because they were afraid of the proceeding. They thought that it was some official proceeding where they could somehow get in trouble.
But all strikes me as being all the more, making it all the more important to find the minor. I mean, if you can't depend upon the parents to be looking out for the minor, how can the guardian look out for them if he doesn't see them or talk with them?
The guardian, Justice Heck, becomes parens patriae, the parent of the country. He then has that very important duty to do what's right for that child.
I just don't see how you can't. I mean, I agree with you. I just don't see how you can if you don't know who it is. If this were an adult and the attorney came into court and said, Your Honor, we'd like to accept this settlement. Of course, I can't find my client, but I'm sure if my client were here, he'd want to settle on this basis. It looks to me like somebody would file a Rule 12 motion pretty quick and say, maybe this is a good settlement and we'd like to get the case over with, but we can't deal with an attorney who doesn't have a client.
Quite possibly, Your Honor, in the case of an adult, but in the case of a minor, the Byrd versus Woodruff case out of Dallas in 1994, where this court denied writ, said two very important things that address your question, that the guardian ad litem is empowered to make decisions for and act on behalf of the minor. And the guardian ad litem, this is the key language, the guardian ad litem stands in the place of and represents the interest of the minor. I read an article, actually, that another justice on the panel wrote about oral argument in front of the Supreme Court, and he said, you better be ready to tell us what your rule of law is, and you better know it, and you better write it down, and you better memorize it. And the rule of law is simply that, out of the Byrd case, that the guardian ad litem should have that power to make decisions for and act on behalf of the child and stand in that child's place, because that's
one thing I'm confused about. There seems to be a disconnect here. We seem to be arguing about whether these children have never been seen and no one knows who they are versus what appears to me to be the language of these individual affidavits that say, seem to imply that the minor has been talked to, there's been a questionnaire prepared. Was there a questionnaire for each minor?
Yes, Your Honor, there was.
So the specific medical symptoms were asked about,
There were none. It was determined there were no medical bills. So there has, it's not like they can't be found. They've been found. They've been questioned. The ad litem looked at those questionnaires and determined no permanent injury. And so I'm a little bit confused on this we don't know who or where they are argument.
You're absolutely right, Justice O'Neill. At the time these clients were signed up, understand that our law firm didn't sign them up on powers of attorney. They were referred to us by lawyers that did. And the requirements that we had when we took over the case was that you need to have a signed power of attorney from the guardian of the child. You needed to have a signed medical authorization from the guardian of the child. We needed to have all medical records with respect to the child. So there is tangible, objective evidence that the people exist. And so the real fiction here is to say that they don't exist. Every one of them has a Social Security number that is on file with the district clerk.
Well, I'm specifically looking at paragraph 8 of the affidavit that says that the guardian's opinion that the minor, that Darius Singleton, is just one that I pulled out at random, has recovered. There are no permanent injuries. My opinion is based on review of the individual files, including medical records, reports of complaints, questionnaires on behalf of each minor, etc. And so, again, it sounds like we're talking about two different cases.
Well, I would agree with you, Your Honor, that the evidence suggests, all the evidence in the record suggests existence, and that existence, whether or not these persons are a figment of someone's imagination, is not an issue in this case. The question is that their parents refused to sign a parental affidavit for one reason or another. One reason being we couldn't find them. Another reason being they wanted to get the child's money. Another reason being, as I said, they were afraid of the meeting or whatever the case may be. But as far as existence, I agree with you, Your Honor, that there is ample evidence in the record that all these children are real people, and as J.P. Smith put it best, it cannot be in their best interest to take their money away and give it back to a tortfeasor that's agreed to pay it.
Mr. Snyder, the chemical release occurred August 21st, 1998, as I read from the records. The lawsuit was filed September 14th, 1998. When were the questionnaires completed that you're referring to?
Many of the questionnaires, Your Honor, I would say the vast majority of them were at or around the time of the chemical release.
In 1998?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you signed up the clients when? Just a year would be sufficient, probably.
In 2001?
3 years later?
I think so, Your Honor, yes.
And the guardian ad litem submitted the affidavits to the trial court when?
In 2002.
4 years later?
Yes, Your Honor.
Based on questionnaires from 1998?
Based on that, based on the medical records that we had, and we had also sent out supplemental questionnaires to all of the clients which said, if you've experienced any further problems, please let us know. And so the ad litem had those to review as well.
Were there supplemental questionnaires for all of the 285 minors with answers received?
I cannot represent to the court that we received answers from all of them, but I can say that we received answers from the vast majority of them.
And they're in the record?
I don't believe that the supplemental questionnaires are part of this court's record. I would be certainly happy to supplement the record with those, Your Honor.
Let me ask you another question. As to the 731 minor claims that were settled, as I read the record in the briefing, KCSI paid the settlement at least in part in consideration for release of liability, all liability. Were releases signed for the 731?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about for the 285 that have not been located, at least in KCI's characterization of it?
Releases were signed for those folks as well.
By whom?
By the guardian ad litem.
Who signed the releases for the 731?
The parent or the next friend.
I see.
Well, are you... Talk to me about mandamus here. I haven't heard you argue mandamus. And we're talking about such things as interlocutory final judgments as though they're an oxymoron. I'm not so sure they are. I mean, you can have judgments that are final as to different parties, but they're interlocutory. They're not appealable yet because they're, all parties haven't been resolved. And so I'm a bit confused. You're not conceding that this is mandamus.
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, I don't think that it's an attack on the on Judge Jameson's conduct. I think that the mandamus, for lack of a better word, was a backdoor way to attack the guardian ad litem's conduct, and in order to get this court to set a rule on what a guardian ad litem has to do in a case such as this.
Do you know any obstacles to severance below?
I beg your pardon?
Do you know of any obstacles that would have been presented to a severance motion below?
Not at all.
And to be clear on paragraph 8 of the affidavit, for example, the guardian says, further, I am not aware of any ongoing symptoms for this minor. But does that really say anything? I mean, neither am I, but who cares?
Well, he says that with a little more information than you have before you. As I was talking to Justice Wainwright, I indicated that we sent out supplemental questionnaires to these folks asking them, are you suffering from anything now? Have you had any effects you haven't told us about? And it wasn't just once. We sent out multiple.
And you got back no way.
Supreme Court, the County of Yalabusha and County of Bolivar cases, similar situation involved termination of parental rights, but you had an ad litem that failed to interview the minors at issue and made a recommendation to the court based upon reports of others and dated reports. And the Mississippi Supreme Court said, you cannot do that. That was not an effective use of your power. The judge, taking what Mr. Smith put in his affidavit, states in her judgment, the guardian ad litem has met with the parents, guardians, and or next friends of each of the minor plaintiffs. And that just was not the case. The evidence was not there. Those people who were present, who we could find, who we could settle, they got what we believe to be a good and fair settlement. Their claims were addressed, their claims were adjudicated, and they received compensation. We're not concerned with those people. It's the fact that we've got a situation where we don't know if 285 of these people even exist. They can't be located. The information...
Well, how can you say they don't? I mean, you've got a name and a Social Security number, questionnaire filled out. How can you say they don't exist? You
know, well, Your Honor, we don't know how those names, how the original plaintiff list came about. We don't know how it was determined that this person was John Smith with Social Security number 457532473, as opposed to Jamie Smith with the same Social Security number. We don't know how the original plaintiff list was compiled. The plaintiffs had filed suit in name. Some questionnaires, and I believe if you go back and look at the questionnaires, for some of the plaintiffs, we have missing questionnaires. Again, this was with the original plaintiffs' attorneys who signed these cases up. All that we were presented with was a list of names with Social Security numbers. We were given all of the questionnaires that were in the possession of Mr.
Last
Grady.
Last address, next friend's name, last known phone number.
Correct. And the information wasn't even current enough for those last known addresses to be used to find these approximately 285 missing individuals. I just don't think a lot of them exist other than in name. And you just haven't had a great avalanche of people just suddenly appear, and despite real parties and interest efforts to find these people, you haven't had the avalanche of people appear saying, oh yeah, we've been missing, here we are. These people, I don't think, exist. And just very briefly to respond to Justice Snyder's question before I sat down earlier on buying the peace, the KCSI asserts that the other defendants aren't here because they had more of a reason to buy the peace. We're willing to take our chances because we feel very strongly that we did nothing wrong originally, which is reflected in our settlement amounts, and that if we do have to defend a suit by two or three of these individuals a couple of years on down the road. We've got a very good defense, and we're willing to access the courts, which is our right, and present our defense, and we think we'd prevail on that.
You said that your study of the case law convinced you that that mandamus was the appropriate way to proceed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And have you given us your best cases in the briefing so far?
I think if you look at Lehman and what is a final judgment and what makes the judgment final for appealable purposes, if you look at the Mid-American case and the situation there, and if you look at the Walker case, which we also cited in our brief, in my humble opinion, that gives us solid basis to argue today that we don't have an adequate remedy of appeal, that petition for writ of mandamus is the way to go. And I disagree, I believe, with Mr. Schneider's statement that we are arguing about an abuse of discretion of the trial court, and we're not trying to backdoor in an attack on the guardian ad litem. We objected to the ad litem's authority or use of authority at the trial court. The trial court overruled our objection. She stated very clearly that you're not getting your money back. I'm not giving you your money back, is her quote. And we did argue at that time that was abuse of her discretion. So that's one element. We don't believe that we had an adequate remedy by appeal.
I asked for your cases.
I'm sorry. The Lehman case cited in our brief, the Mid-American case cited in our brief, and the Walker opinion cited in our brief.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the arguments in this morning's cases. The Supreme Court has been privileged to sit here at South Texas in these beautiful facilities and pay tribute to Professor Treese and join with you. And congratulations to all who made this beautiful facility possible, and we hope you enjoy it for many years to come. Marshall will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.